Blog Talk Radio.
And now a brief message from our sponsor. Reality Books presents Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. The author is Marshall Washington Cabinus Abui, the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, a message that will change America. Buy your copy today. $20 is all it costs, plus $5 postage and handling. To order your copy of the book written by the great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, send a text message. Include your full name and how many books you would like to purchase. Send to area code 706-399-5006. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. A message that will change America. Send your text message, including your full name and how many books you would like to purchase, to area code 706-399-5006.
Good evening and welcome to everyone who has joined us on this beginning of springtime evening. The weather here in Augusta, Georgia, began to warm up. The trees have already begun to pollinate heavily, and the branches of the trees are now filled with new green sprouts. And so that indicates that we're in for another part of the year called spring. And so we welcome you all who are joining us tonight. And we hope that those of you who are listening via the internet will come on board and join us in the family room via the telephone on the Blog Talk Radio network so that we can hear your opinion. Because we do have a controversial subject this evening, actually. It should generate a good conversation. We're waiting for some of our regular panelists to join us. But I will go ahead and take this opportunity to announce the topic for tonight so that those of you who are listening via the internet can know what we're going to talk about in case you would like to go ahead and come on board and join us because I do believe that you will find that there are pros and cons on this particular topic, and we'd like to hear what you have to say. So the topic is, did the black people of Africa deserve to be put into slavery under Europeans because of something that they did to bring about this horrific situation, which lasted in one form or another for nearly 400 years in the United States of America? So go ahead and write this number down and call in and let us hear your opinion. The number is 657-383-0671. I'll repeat again in a couple of minutes to give you a chance to go and find something with which to write down the number. But I'll repeat the topic now. Did the black people of Africa deserve to be put into slavery under Europeans because of something that they did to bring about this horrific situation, which lasted in one form or another for nearly 400 years in the United States of America? Your opinion is very welcome, so please share it with us tonight. And I'll repeat the number to call in. It's 657-383-0671. 657-383-0671. Did the black people of Africa deserve to be put into slavery under Europeans because of something that they did to bring about this horrific situation, which lasted in one form or another for nearly 400 years in the United States of America? And so that's what we're going to talk about tonight. And while we're discussing that topic, while we're waiting for others to come on board, I wanted to share something from the history of our people. And this is from a book, A History of Black America, to Howard O. Lindsay. And this book is actually a pictorial book that is filled with pictures, but also historical texts. And so we're going to go ahead. This is actually a book that was published in 1994. We're going to go ahead and read something from this book. says the culture of the West Africans was both rich and diverse. It was different from European culture, but in no sense inferior to it. When the slavers came to West Africa, assaulting both and their culture, it was they who played the role of barbarians. The slave trade would cause tremendous upheaval in the life and culture of traditional West Africa, but of course even more in the lives and culture of the West Africans brought to the New World in chains. The Middle Passage would involve millions of Africans in one of the most horrendous undertakings in human history. And one of its effects would be the creation of a new kind of human being, the African American. Now, the author here is being rather kind because the new kind of human being actually was the Negro. The Africans, prior to being put into slavery, did not consider themselves Negroes. They were whatever their particular culture of their land happened to be. Some were from Senegal, and they were Senegalese. Some were from Gambia, and they were Gambians. Some were from Dahomey, they were Dahomeans. And some were from Benin, they were Beninians. Some were from Ghana, they were Ghanaians, et cetera, et cetera. And they had their own individual culture. They had their own individual system of government. And they had their own religious beliefs. Many of the original people, in fact, most of the first people came from countries that were Islamic, like Gambia, like Senegal, like Sierra Leone. Even Nigeria at that time was largely Muslim. And, of course, they weren't allowed to practice Islam once they were taken away from Africa. And for many years, they weren't allowed to practice any religion, but they were taught by people who told them that God said that they were destined to be slaves to the white people. So, going back to the book, Dr. Howard O. Lindsay says, contrary to popular belief, the first Africans in the New World were not slaves. This may indeed have been among the first people from the Eastern Hemisphere to visit the New World. So there is some evidence that Africans could have arrived in the Americas as early as the 1300s. In fact, recent analysis of the Olmec civilization puts the Africans in America even back as far as 400-500 BC and even further back. My suspicion is that the more that they dig, the more they're going to find evidence that the Africans even preceded the Asians that came over from places such as Asia, Mongolia, and some even say that they originated in India. This is the teaching of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, but we do know they came from Asia. And it said they came from Asia between 14 and 16,000 years ago. I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't find African people or people who look like Africans here when they arrived. I cannot believe that this continent that was actually millions of years old, if not billions of years old, was unpopulated by human beings until 16,000 years ago. But Dr. Lindsay says that Dr. Ivan Van Sertima speculates that Central America may receive African visitors during the era of the Mali Empire in West Africa. And then he goes on to say that Noah was the first Africans to arrive in what would become the United States. Slaves, they were probably indentured servants, 20 of whom landed at Jamestown, Virginia in 1619, a year before the Pilgrims reached New England. Slavery was not at this time even a developing institution, but already America was beginning to feel the urge to fill its basic need, its most basic need, building a cheap, reliable source of labor. The book goes on to say that in 1619, the capacity of North America to generate only beginning to be appreciated. It did not seem to offer the same treasure trove of gold, silver, or other precious minerals that the Spaniards had found in the South, but no one could doubt its agricultural potential. Many valuable crops, such as cotton, tobacco, sugar, and rice, could not be grown on a profitable scale in Europe, but apparently could be in the Western Hemisphere. Could be, that is, if a way could be found to offset the high cost of transporting them or their derivative products back to Europe. The most obvious answer to that problem was to cut labor costs, cut them indeed to levels far below any then existing in Europe. But that could be done only if a large labor force of a wholly new kind could be found. And finding such a source was to be a major preoccupation of the North American colonists for the roughly 40-year period between 1619 and 1660. The first group to which the North American colonies turned to fill their labor needs were the Europeans, mainly British, poor, and the condition under which these poor whites were brought to the New World can, in general terms, be described as indentured servitude. Technically, according to Dr. Lindsay, the term embraces several categories: indentured servants, tenant farmers, redemptors, bond servants, apprentices, and so on. But all were similar in general form. Typically, the system involved a colonist paying the passage of someone from England or Europe to work in America as a servant, farm worker, or skilled tradesmen. Before the Europeans left home, he would sign a contract specifying his duties, his term of service, which was usually 7 years, and his compensation, which was usually very low. Once the parties agreed, the contract was often cut into two halves, the American employer keeping one part and the servant the other. In theory, it seemed like a fair and logical method to solve the labor problem. In reality, the flaws of the system began to appear almost immediately. Even though 7 years might seem a considerable time to spend as a servant, it was not long enough. If the American employer had to train his servant in a trade, by the time the servant became fully proficient, he was free. The labor force was not really permanent, nor did it ever reach the numbers hoped for by the colonial authorities. And worst of all, it was not nearly cheap enough. The system also laid the groundwork for future social troubles. Though this did not become evident until later, many of the people who came from England were single males, young single males. They had envisioned working for a term of years and accumulating enough money and or land to join the planter class. For most, this never happened. Instead, the situation produced in some colonies groups of young landless men with few prospects and a good deal of resentment against the society from which they were excluded. Inevitably, this led to various outbursts of violence, probably the most famous of which was Bacon's Rebellion in 1676. This was in Virginia, and we won't go into details, but many of these people who were poor, formerly indentured servants, rebelled against the king's representative, Lord Berkeley, being led by a gentleman by the name of Mr. Bacon. Another group which the early colonists hoped might provide a source of cheap labor were the Native Americans. And many colonists experimented with Indian labor at one time or another, but the results were always disappointing. The most basic problem was simply that the New World Indians were not numerous enough to meet the enormous needs of colonial labor. And this was complicated by the fact of low Indian resistance to Old World diseases. A common Old World disease, such as smallpox, could wipe out whole villages once the infection set in. Also, there was the problem of the whole tenor of Indian colonist relations, which were at best uneasy and often, more often than not, actually generated into open warfare. From the colonist point of view, the Indians always had to be thought of as potentially hostile. They could not easily be recruited for voluntary labor, and any attempt to make them work involuntarily stood a good chance of once again setting the tribes on the war path. So since the Native Americans could not be counted on to fill their labor needs, the colonists had to settle for taking away the Indians' land. And that became the primary preoccupation of the colonists, to move the Indians off of their land. There were, in some cases, treaties made with the Native Americans to give the acquisition of their territory at least a quasi-legal basis. Even when the original treaties were broken, and that happened whenever it was convenient or profitable. In fact, I teach American history, and I recently came across a statement that there was only one treaty out of all of the treaties were made with the Indians that was kept. And, of course, eventually this was over a period of time. This was even broken. But it took many years for that to happen. But the fact is that there was never any intention to treat the Indians fairly, only to remove them from the land that promised well for the colonists. So you when the original treaties were broken, which was whenever it was convenient or profitable, they were usually replaced by yet other treaties or legal agreements. And for the Africans, however, there would not even be the fiction of treaties. And so we move now to a short discussion of the rise of African slavery. The idea that African slaves might be the answer to North America's labor problem dawned on the colonists only gradually, and to their credit, some colonists, mainly in New England, refused to entertain the idea at all. But in purely economic terms, without reference to any moral considerations, the arguments in favor of such a solution were powerful. Unlike indentured Europeans or Indians, Africans were potentially in unlimited supply. As slaves, they would be as cheap as any form of labor available anywhere in the world. At the same time, they represented a very high quality of labor, since most were already skilled farmers, stockmen, meaning husbandry, animal husbandry men or women, and artisans. And they understood meats. They understood the techniques of cooperative effort and the division of labor. Want to take a short break right now. Play a little music. I need to check on some technical issues. Continue our broadcast. I just received word that those who call in to hear the show may actually get a notification that there are no shows scheduled for the next 24 hours. Unfortunately, our Blog Talk Radio provider is having some technical difficulties. As a result, you may get that message. The way I suggest that you do, we'll go ahead and continue for a few more minutes with giving you some of this history, and we'll try to repeat this topic next week. But the fact of the matter is that you can, if you're listening via the internet, you can go ahead and continue to listen. But we will broadcast this program again, and you can hear the show if you go up on blogtalkradio.com, blogtalkradio.com, Booker T. Washington Speaks. So at this time, we're going to return back to the program and continue with the history that we've been broadcasting. So we apologize for the problem, but this is a problem that happened only once that I have been using the Blog Talk Radio service. And as a result, people were not able to dial in and participate. So we're going to just go ahead and wrap up with some history, and we'll be finished for this week. But we're going to talk now about some of the things that happened during the time of slavery. The first thing we have to understand is that the African people had established civilizations that went back thousands and thousands of years. And they were very complex and sometimes simple, but highly developed civilizations. What happened to the black people when they were put in chains and brought to America is that they were separated from their own people and divided up from families and mixed up so that they could no longer transmit their native culture. Not only that, but there was every attempt made to change them from personhood to property, which was called chattel, such as the cows, pigs, horses, mules, and other property, including the tools that were used for farming. They were put in that kind of category. Some managed to cling to some aspect of the African cultural ancestry, and a lot of this is represented in what you see in the churches in the black community. For example, the call and response type of music that came from Africa. But most of the Africans who were caught up in the Atlantic slave trade came from West Africa, an area roughly from the Senegal River in the north to the Congo River in the south. While these Africans represented a number of different societies, languages, and religions, they shared many cultural traits, and some of the most fundamental of these can still be discerned in contemporary African-American culture. The heart of all social, economic, and political life for most West Africans was the extended family. The core of such a family consisted of a father and his brothers along with their families, but it also extended backwards in time to include each man's father and his uncles as well as their families. When a man and his wife had children, the sons would take wives who would become part of the extended family, and the daughters would leave home when they married to become part of their husband's extended families. Also part of every family were the spirits of all the deceased ancestors within the family's collective memory. A family usually lived in a village. A village is a small rural type of town composed of a number of other extended families. And the families often shared the same lineage. In other words, were presumed to have originated from a common blood ancestor. Several lineages in turn could form a clan, which is a group thought to be descended from a common mythical ancestor or dependent on the protection of a supernatural guardian. Africans considered all children responsible for all, pardon me, Africans considered all adults responsible for all the children of the village, in other words, of the small town, and by the same token, children were expected to obey all adults as if they were their biological parents. This communal emphasis on child rearing was at once cultural and practical. Daughters were essential to the survival of the race, and sons would carry a family name into the next generation, and both were vital to a family's well-being. It was they who had to be counted on to look after the elderly when they became too old to support themselves. It was they who had to take over when a family member became sick, injured, or otherwise incapacitated. Their labor in the house or in the field increased the families and therefore the community's wealth, and their members added to the community's ability to defend itself against outside attack. Status of women in this patrilineal society was clearly subordinate, but it would be a mistake to exaggerate the degree of that subordination. Wives had clearly defined rights, and if they were violated, if these women's rights were violated, it was understood that the victims' families could and would seek revenge or vengeance. When a bride was chosen, custom demanded that the prospective groom give her family what they called a bride price, but we call it in America a dowry. In effect, the husband's family was compensating the bride's family for losing so valuable a person. That women were uniquely valuable members of African society, there was never the slightest doubt. West Africans believed the spirits of dead ancestors within collective village. And we're going to go ahead and play some music again. We have a call we have to take on another line, so please bear with us. Thank you. So we're going to go ahead and wrap up our show for tonight. There's more. We'll continue this history lesson at a future time. But the point that we want to make here, in keeping with our topic for tonight, is very important. Tonight's topic was, did the black people of Africa deserve to be put into slavery under Europeans because of something that they did to bring about this horrific situation, which lasted in one form or another, for 400 years. So there's a lot that we need to learn so that we can understand exactly what is going on today in America concerning the situation involving the descendants of these Africans, the descendants of these people who were brought here to America. And so I want to end by reading something from a book called The Dahomian. And this is about the beginning of slavery. Then Wesu did turn and saw the big crewmen of that seacoast race who were the original inhabitants of Wada holding dying baby between them. One of them had his fish knife, the sixth sharp blade they used to scale and gut the fish that were their only food, pressed across her slender throat. And what invaded Hesu then at that sight could not be put into words and has no name, because words, names are only approximations, and this was an absolute. And death is an absolute, except that death is kinder. He drew the blade away from Atadeku's throat, hearing as he did so her voice choked off, taunt coming over to him out of that absolute, that horror, except that horror too diminished the reality, as any descriptive term had to. Then what was happening, the way he felt existing on levels so far beyond ordinary experience that any attempt to think out ways to put them even in a language such as rich and intricate as foul became the sort of meaningless and redundant absurdity that the phrase perfect perfection is. She was saying, no, you can't. You can't. Let them kill me. Don't make me go on living. Not with this, remembering it. But he let the fingers of his two hands open and the blades clattered to the ground. Tie him up, Atadeku said. Then bring out his women, an absolute, the ropes bit into the flesh of his wrists where they crossed them behind his back. A loop of hemp dug into his throat. The longer end of it swung out, then looped around Alejandro's neck and around Soye's. The only way any of them could even start to run was to drag all of the others behind him, strangling them. Even on the open savannah, they would not get very far. The crewmen came out of the women's quarters, pushing the women before them. Their leader, Juan Coica, pointed at Cujo. "This one no good," he said in his broken file. "Too old. Nobody will buy." "I kill her, yes?" "Yes," Tadeku said. The crewman wiped his crescent-shaped blade almost gently across the throat of maternal tenderness. The long, long memories of Naya Sanu's Wesu's youth, half his origin, his roots in love and time. Cujo didn't scream. She couldn't. The air from her severed windpipe made a whistling sound. And then she took half a step toward her tall son and went down upon the earth. Wesu didn't say anything. He didn't moan or scream or cry. Absolutes and the normal responses of human emotion are suspended before absolutes, just as words are. "Them babies," the crewman said, "no good. Die in carpool. Die on ship. In the way, Prince." Now, even after Deku was caught in hell by the thing men call horror, for want of a newer, better word, since the long tides of man's history have robbed the old one and the thing itself of all meaning, reducing them to routine, to casualness. "For far's sake, Koika," he said, "I don't know." "You don't know. I know. Women young make more babies later on." He pointed at Adahosi, said, "Except this one, maybe. Maybe I kill her, too, yes?" "No," Atsudeku said. "Take her along and the babies. Tomorrow we'll think of a way." Kiss said it was clear that the prince did not and could not control him. "No way now." He took Jibenu, Wesu's first son, eldest from Alihosi's arms. The way she screamed was an absolute too. Wesu couldn't even hear the sound the baby's head made smashing against the wall as Koika swung him by his tiny, beautiful feet. All he could do was to stare and stare and stare at that red splotch on the gray-brown wall, dripping blood and brains on the light of the torches. So six-wave, a lioness, they had to club her unconscious to get little Kaosu away from her. Hulu faded outright as the twins were torn from her grasp. So Kami screamed and vomited at the same time on Hulu's behalf, perhaps having no children of her own, or perhaps dying babies who, when they brought tiny exigent Wesu out of her house, stood there like a statue and then said slowly, carefully, quietly, in a voice that was the most absolute of all absolutes, "Please, with the hands, don't smash her head." Koika looked at her. "You something, woman. All right. I choke her a little only. Won't hurt. You make new one tomorrow night with the prince, with me." It was then that Wesu broke or exploded or both. He surged forward, dragging Soye and Alahuno behind him as though They were tiny wooden dolls, big and heavy as they were. Waco growled something in his guttural tongue, and his warrior's club whistled to the earth with his